Spy in the Sky. Interview. Ola Demogod. Part 4.
Putting a, you know, a finger right in the eye of the South African regime, making them even more obvious that they wanted to kill him. But anyway, this contract was given to Craig Williamson, Colonel Craig Williamson, and he had his headquarters just outside Johannesburg in a little farm called Daisy Farm. It was a little farm in the countryside, but it was actually like a central of terror, of torture and terror, really awful, awful place. Anyway, so for some months there, Craig Williamson put together a team of different assassins. He used some of his own people, one of them being a Rhodesian guy called Anthony White. He used some West German people who was also working for BOS, the South African secret police. And he used some, he had contacts in Sweden, these right-wing policemen in Sweden. He used a Norwegian mercenary, and he used some American people as well, or one American that used to be, there's some direct connections to the JFK assassination that I can do afterwards. But anyway, he put together this team of highly skilled assassins with no apparent connection, and all of them working indirectly or connected with the Stay Behind movement that, as far as I know, you already presented in your program.
That we have.
Yeah. Anyway, super. So this team was sent, it was prepared for a couple of months, and then it was sent, they came in, like three of them flew in from South Africa to Luxembourg. They were picked up there by, his name was Franz Esser, West German, but agent for South African BOS. He drove them to Sweden, through Denmark and into Sweden, and then they, in a camper van, and they were hiding out in the forest in Sweden first, and then with the help of these right-wing policemen in Stockholm from the baseball gang, they helped them with the logistics, with weapons, with housing, with ammo, food, all of these type of things. Other people were flown in private planes. Some came in cars and so on. So the whole team were assembled outside Stockholm. And after that, they were split up in groups, and they were put to keep Olof Palme under surveillance from, I think, late November and then January and February. During this time, he was under surveillance by these people. He was a weapon expert and Nazi. He was the one who was supposed to supply them with guns and fake ammo. Fake ammo. But they were not supposed to know that it was fake. Do you see what I'm saying? So the people doing the assassination believed that they were actually killing him,
mm-hmm.
but the bullets were fake. That was the whole idea of the setup. Okay, so in the meantime, when all of these things were going on and Palme was clearing his name, this hit team was getting closer and closer to the date when they were planning to get him. At the same time, there was a series of meetings arranged by members of the elite, because they were, like I told you before, they were very pissed off with his behavior and all the things that he was doing against them and acting totally unreliable. They couldn't control him anymore. And in these meetings, one of the meetings were in Wiltshire in England, and there were people from NATO, there were people from the big banks, there were politicians, there were military people, secret service, different from different countries. And they decided that this guy has crossed the line. We need to take him out before it's too late, because he's just doing totally stupid things. One of the things that they feared the most was that he wanted to make Sweden, and thereby Scandinavia, a nuclear-free zone, meaning that nuclear submarines and these were no longer allowed in that area, and also no nuclear weapons, and so it was messing it up big time for them strategically. It was very important for them, mm-hmm. to stop him. So they assigned a hit team to take him out. And while they were doing preparing this, they somehow heard of this other assassination plan going on. So if we call them the Palmer team and the NATO team, then we separate them, okay?
Mm-hmm.
The Palmer team is the fake one, and the NATO team is the one that are pissed off with him and wants to take him out. He was shot just outside the Skandia building. The Skandia is an insurance company in Sweden, but it was also the headquarters during many years of Stay Behind. And Olof Palme was very involved in the creation of this Stay Behind in Sweden and the development of Stay Behind. So that building is very central in this. And underneath, under the level of subways, the subway system in Stockholm, the level below that, there's a network of about 618 kilometers of tunnels.
That's hard to believe.
No, but there, under many of the big cities in Europe, at least, you have these network of tunnels. And these are used by, you tell me, but military, whatever. And it also connects all the major buildings, you know, the parliament, the palace, the...
Everything, yeah.
The banker, all the so-called important people. And it was a major part of the Stay Behind build up that they would, in case of an invasion, all the so-called important people could be smuggled out through these tunnels and then taken to Norway, flown to London, and then from London they could arrange for defense against whoever was the invaders.
Yeah, it's just that Stockholm's not a very large city, and 602 kilometers, that's an incredible amount. That's a network.
It is a network, absolute network. And anyway, so there's this network underneath the Skandia building. I spoke to the former security chief of Skandia, and he confirmed these tunnels. So one of the ideas in this conspiracy as well was to get Palme either out with one of the ambulances, because there was two ambulances this evening, supposed to be, to get him out either with the ambulance or through this tunnel system, and to get him out there, and then with a private plane, it was a private jet plane borrowed from the French government, Laurent Fabius, the prime minister, he was the one who lent it out. It was part of the French presidential fleet. It was called GLAM, G-L-A-M, GLAM, the GLAM fleet. They borrowed this airplane that was on standby to help him out that evening. Anyway, so where are we? On the night of the assassination, they had decided that was the night he was supposed to be hit. So he leaves his home, and one of the last people he speaks on the phone is with Sven Aspling, who was one of the main creators of Stay Behind, one of the people who built the whole thing up in Sweden. One of his last phone calls, if not the last one, was to him. Then he went to the cinema, and that was a perfect setup for the hit team as well, because then they knew for sure that he was going to be stuck in one place for at least an hour and a half. So while he was in there, the hit team positioned itself around the cinema building, and also they had three different escape cars. There was a blue Volkswagen Passat, and a red Ford Escort, and a white Volvo 244. And so people from the hit team were in these three different escape cars. Also, you had this police car, if you remember, the one that passed the witness that came running. That guy with a police commissioner in it was driving around in central Stockholm with the back filled with technical equipment. And what I think is that cars was used to amplify the signal between the walkie-talkies, because there's a lot of high buildings in central Stockholm, or from Swedish point of view, high buildings, but it's difficult for the signal to go through in the small streets type of thing. And then the whole operation was conducted from a commando center. It's about 200 meters from where he was shot, underneath a fire station. It's called Johannes Brandstation. 6 floors down, there's what is today the 112 center.
Which is the emergency center.
Yeah, today it's used by them. But at the time of the assassination, it was used by Stay Behind. And I truly believe that is from where the whole assassination was conducted, by Craig Williamson and many other people were down in that center there that evening, just a few hundred meters from where it actually happened. Anyway, so the Palmer family was totally informed and knew everything that was going to happen, that their part was to act the whole thing out and then point out a patsy and case closed, get Olof Palme out of the country, get him treatment, and then they could come and visit and everything would be fine. They would be forever, looked upon as saints and angels, and everything would be good. What happened, though, was that when the Palme couple was walking down the street, the NATO team had placed at least one sniper on the other side of the street. There was a sniper and a spotter on the other side of the building, on top of the building on the other side of the street. So when Palmer came and passed the shooter down on street level, the guy who was supposed to hit him, but with fake bullets, when that guy walked up behind him and fired the fake bullet, at the exact same time, a shot was fired from the building across the street, hitting Palmer from the front with a small caliber, high-velocity bullet, killing that person. So he went down, and this is why they have this massive problem with the autopsy, because the bullet is actually from the front, not from the back. You know, and it's different angle, different ammo, different. It doesn't make any sense at all.
Because the guy that came up behind him also pulled his shoulder. Is that right? Like pulled him back and.
That is what one witness says.
Exposed his chest.
No. He just put his hand on his shoulder and fired with the other hand. There was no pulling and no nothing like that. But. So the first team, the Palmer team, thinks that they committed the hit, and the people, the police coming to the place, or everyone involved, still thinks that it's a fake assassination. You know, that's why everybody takes it so casual. You know, they're running around like it was a game. Mm-hmm. They're not doing it on purpose, because the people there knew that it was fake. They had no idea that the person there had actually been murdered, you know. And then they were supposed to be picked up by one ambulance, but instead he was picked up by another one. And here I think that the NATO team can have messed things up for them. One with the police car that started talking to the patsy, remember?
Mm-hmm.
The one that interfered. And also with a second ambulance that came first and obstructed the whole thing. Because what happened was that they, when Palmer was picked up in an ambulance and his wife came in the ambulance, according to witnesses, but when they arrived to the hospital, they were delayed a few minutes, and they say that the ambulance driver took the wrong way. I mean, come on, it's central Stockholm. It's not like rocket science. It's not that big a place. And also, the coat that she had on, the one that they were taking photos when she ran into the hospital. That is not the same coat as the one that has been brought forward with the bullet holes in it, you know, proving that she was actually being shot at. It's not the same model of coat.
Mm-hmm.
So here's one very strange thing about the Palmer family. There's so many, many things around them that is weird.
But did she arrive at the hospital in the ambulance or...?
No, she arrived in a police car.
But she left in the ambulance?
Yeah.
Okay.
And a different coat.
Yeah.
But what I think it's even one more level to it, because right in front of the Scandia building, the Stay Behind headquarters building, there is a triangular, what do you call it, like a billboard for ads.
Mm-hmm.
And what some witnesses saw, that Olof Palme walked on the outside, that's almost down on the street, you know, taking a step off the pavement. It's that far out to the side of the pavement that he was walking on the outside, and then he came back and walked towards his wife. Then they walked towards the killer, and then the shots were fired. That's one thing, detail just to make a note of. At the same time, also, another witness met the couple when they were walking towards the site where he was shot. And when you time the distance from where he met them until he heard the shots fired, there's like half a minute that doesn't match up without them. If they continued walking, they would have been like 200 meters further down the road. Meaning that the couple, for some reason, stopped outside the Scandia building for half a minute, then came and the shots were fired. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
So what it seems like, and what I've also spoken to people on the inside, and this is what they confirmed to me, was that there was a double, that there were two doubles. Not only Palmer, but also his wife were swapped just outside the Scandia building, on that where this stand is. You know, it's triangular. If you look from above, it's a triangular shape,
mm-hmm.
meaning it's perfect to hide behind as well, you know, and with bad lighting and so on. So it seems like they knew Palmer, since he knew that the shots were going to be fired on at the corner, he walked up and swapped with the other couple behind this ad, the banner, then talked for a few, I mean, it took like 20, 30 seconds to make the swap, and then the fake couple walked up towards where he was being shot, and then the double was the one that got shot.
Okay.
At the same time, the real couple, when the shots were fired and everybody was looking that way, they ran from this banner, whatever you want to call it, triangular ad stand. There's just 2-3 meters across, and there's the entrance to the Scandia building. You know, so boom, boom, everybody looks that way. You just go straight across in there and then straight down into the tunnel system, if that's the way you want to go. Or if they left in the ambulance, I'm not sure who was in the ambulance. I think it was the double that came into the ambulance. The real Lisbeth Palmer was taken by a police car from the basement of the Scandia building to the hospital. That is why she arrived in the police car. And, there's many different question marks. But what seems to be true, though, is that he was taken by, that Olof Palme was then taken to the airport while the double was being driven to the hospital. He was taken to the airport and brought out in this private jet together with Cord Lidbom, his advisor, and another guy who was very central in this as well, called Ebbe Karlsson, who is a very, very strange person. But anyway, so I must say that after all of these years looking into this, I believe that the grave in Stockholm is empty.
Mm-hmm.
It takes a lot to say that, but I really do not believe that there's anyone in that grave. It would be really interesting if it would be possible to with modern technology or whatever, just scan the grave, see if there's anyone in there. Because I think it's an empty grave there. I think that Palme, if he's still alive, he could well be, but he would be in his 80s or something like that. But I think, according to some info I got, that he died in Toronto in 1996. And now I'm writing a novel called Guilty Victim. Guilty Victim, which is like it's written in, like in a Dan Brown novel, and it's telling exactly this story, but in an hopefully easier way to understand how it's all connected, because it might seem very, very complicated, which it is, but to explain it so that somebody who's not really into all the details can understand it, that is what I'm aiming at.
You don't think that being in novel form, it could work against what you intend to do?
I write it in novel form with if I change anything at all, it will just be the names. Everything else will be exactly the way it is, or the way it was. And then in the beginning, I write any similarities with actual events are
such a coincidence.
Intended.
Are intended? Oh, okay, good. Yeah.
Are intended.
The
only reason I changed the name so far is just to not get sued from here to the moon. Because I pinpoint all of them exactly to their parts, and my aim is to get this made as a film or a TV thriller, but based on strictly based on historical facts. The slightest details.
Have you had any interest in that area?
I prefer not to say anything at this moment, but things look good.
No, I can understand. I can understand you not wanting to say. Coming from theatre background, it's always don't say anything until it happens.
Exactly, and also since what I've just explained, I tell you, if you ask other researchers in this area, no one will agree with this. Or very few people will agree with it. But there are people on very high levels that do agree with this, who have been on very close terms with central figures in this drama, who are saying exactly the same. So just like Mahatma Gandhi said, even if you're a minority of one, the truth is still the truth. I truly believe that this is what happens, because suddenly if you come from this angle and see it like this type of event, everything makes sense. Every single little detail makes sense. And if you come from any other angle, it's a big mystery. It's a big enigma inside a labyrinth, you know. So we're back to Farmer Brown logic. What makes sense? How can you connect the dots? And this, when from coming from this angle, suddenly every single piece fits in.
Yeah, it's from my training, it's termed the author's view. To go so far back that you can actually have the whole story in your view, and only then can you actually see how it fits together.
Over the years, I found so many jigsaw pieces, you know, of facts, and it's been like putting them together, but face down. So I haven't been able to see what image I'm putting together, you know, until they all fit together, and then slowly being able to turn it around and see, see a picture that I had absolutely no idea from start.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned the Scandia building as being more than likely the exit point for Olaf and Lisbeth, but
it's very central. In
his father worked for Scandia.
I tell you, his granddad started Scandia, and it used to be called something else, and that was very connected with the Nazis in Berlin during the Hitler era.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, so Scandia has always been connected with some kind of secret
organization.
Yeah, in different aspects. It is an insurance company, a normal insurance company on the surface, but it keeps popping up in different areas where there's scandals or money has been transferred in strange ways, or people have had strange careers. You know, they made what looked to be a massive mistake, and then their career has just jumped up, and suddenly they're one of the bosses on Scandia.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know, just like Lord Carrington by mistake started the whole Falkland War,
mm-hmm.
and then he, after that, he became General Secretary of NATO. I mean, other normal people, if you mess up, if you do something you're not supposed to do, you get knocked down. But here, they work for secret interests, so that when they do what they're told, which looks like a mistake to our eyes, that is when they get promoted.
Mm-hmm.
And here with Scandia, you see these people, absolute losers, some of them, you know, no brains, and then poof, they get high up in this. So there's a very smelly sensation around that company, in my opinion.
Yeah. Well, Ola, that wraps it up for this time, I'd imagine. That's quite a lot of information for people to digest and get through.
Yeah.
Thank you for your time. Just mention your website again, if you could, for people.
It's www.murderofpalme.com. Murderofpalme.com.
And that's spelled P-A-L-M-E.
Yep.
Great. Well, thank you very much for your time, Ola, and I wish you all the success. And I'll keep on referring people to your website for your book, Coup d'etat in slow motion, as well as for your music as well.
That's very kind of you. And like anyone interested, on my website, I've got other books as well, and music as well, and everything is to download for free. So I hope you enjoy it.
Thank you very much.